friends. It is Thursday, June 9th. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. Thanks for listening to this program. You may still donate to the RBN Pledge Drive, which ends within the hour. You can do that online at republicbroadcasting.org, by mail, or by phone at 800-724-2719. If you have not donated yet, please consider doing that. If you wish to see information on past or future guests for this program, go to spingola.com. To listen to any previous programs on RBN, go to republicbroadcasting.org. The archives are accessible for only $1.33 per month. One of our listeners created a Spingola Speaks YouTube channel. There's a link on my homepage and the radio schedule page. He provides snippets of several of my programs and helps to introduce people to RBN. We will take calls after my guest has presented his information when we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Dave McGowan, the author of Derailing Democracy, The America the Media Don't Want You to See, also Understanding the F Word, and Program to Kill, The Politics of Serial Murder. His website is davesweb.cnchost.com. There is a link on the radio schedule page for his website. Welcome to the program, Dave.
Hi, glad, good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. I read your first book, Derailing Democracy, and it's very well done. It's a really great book. Very good book.
Thank you very much. It's a little dated now, you know, being that it's a I think it came out like a year before 9/11, which, you know, completely changed the political landscape here pretty much. But it still has some value because the interesting thing is that so much of this stuff was actually already in the works, you know, as far as sort of the groundwork for the Patriot Act and you know, all of the stuff that we've seen happened post 9/11 that has been, you know, that 9/11 has been used as a pretext for, and the value that that book has, I think, is that it documented before 9/11 how all of these things were already actually in the works, just sort of waiting for a pretext to implement. But I believe it might actually be out of print now. I'm not entirely sure, but I think it might be out of print. So I don't know if that particular one is even still available, but
people could find it on Amazon as a used book, but it definitely has a lot of, I like all the statistics you have in here regarding the military industrial complex and all the weapons and who has provided all the training for all of the terrorist acts throughout the world, who provided all the guns, the ammunition, everything. I mean, it's, you have it so well documented. It's very well done.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's been years since anyone's even mentioned that book. It's kind of weird. I don't even remember myself all that clearly what all's in there.
Oh, it's good. You ought to read it.
Yeah, maybe I'm curious.
Okay, we are going to go to a 3-minute break. Then we're going to come back and talk about Laurel Canyon, which is amazing. This series is amazing. Stay tuned. Be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back, friends. My guest today is Dave McGowan, the author of Derailing Democracy, The America the Media Don't Want You to See. And it is available on Amazon. I just took a little peek, and they have some used copies of it there. But we're going to talk about Laurel Canyon and the birth of the hippie generation. Now, Dave, in part two, you wrote, and I quote, "Are we to believe that the only kids from that era who had any musical talent were the sons and daughters of Navy admirals, chemical warfare engineers, and Air Force intelligence officers, or are they just the ones who were signed to lucrative contracts and relentlessly promoted by their labels and the media?"
Did I write that?
You did. You did.
Yeah, that's what I found in looking into this story time after time after time as I looked into the backgrounds of all of the big-name musicians who populated Laurel Canyon in the mid to late 1960s. We're talking about, you know, people that led the most influential bands of the era, like Jim Morrison of The Doors and David Crosby of The Byrds and Stephen Stills of Buffalo Springfield and Frank Zappa of The Mothers of Invention, John Phillips of The Mamas and the Papas, and on down the line. And what I found time after time is that pretty much every one of them has direct connections to the, you know, quote-unquote military intelligence complex and quite deep, you know, family connections. And, you know, if you find that maybe, you know, once or twice, you might be tempted to just write it off as, you know, a sort of a trivial, insignificant, and interesting, but, you know, not necessarily relevant detail, but when you find it time after time after time, you know, at some point, it's no longer, it can no longer be written off to coincidence or whatnot. There had to be some behind the scenes, manipulations that went into creating a scene where all of these sort of people who represented, you know, the anti-war movement and peace and love and all that stuff were deeply tied to the intelligence community, you know, through family connections and otherwise. You know, as a few examples, Jim Morrison's father was a Navy admiral, and not just any Navy admiral, but the one who happened to be in command of the Pacific Fleet that was involved in the Gulf of Tonkin incident. He was the commanding officer of those ships. So he was, you know, a direct conspirator, so to speak, in staging, because it's now pretty well acknowledged by you know, most people that the Gulf of Tonkin incident didn't really even happen. It was basically a staged, manipulated event designed to draw the U.S. deeper and deeper into the Vietnam War. And you know, here you have this guy's father was a major player in that whole scenario at the very same time that the son was, you know, coming to the forefront as, you know, the leader of the, you know, one of the figureheads of the anti-war peace and love movement. And, you know, Frank Zappa's father was a engineer at the Edgewood Arsenal, I think it was, as a, you know, chemical biological warfare engineer. John Phillips' father was a career Marine Corps officer, and his mother worked at the Pentagon, and his first wife worked at the Pentagon. And he himself went to Annapolis, you know, got an appointment to Annapolis Naval Academy. So, you know, he had very deep connections, and just on and on and on and on and on, you know, right down through the list. And then, you know, from there, I also took a look at, because in addition to the musicians in Laurel Canyon, there was this other sort of Hollywood subculture of young actors who were known as the Young Turks, which was like Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper and Bruce Dern and Sharon Tate and Jane Fonda and you know, all of these people. And as I started to look into their backgrounds, once again, right down the line, you have the same, you know, the same pattern. Bruce Dern, one of his uncles, I believe it was like Skull and Bones, and, you know, he had some other deep connections. And Dennis Hopper is fairly recently acknowledged that his dad was OSS, you know, which is the precursor to the CIA. And just so, you know, I mean, it's just overwhelming at some point that, you know, that every one of these people seem to come from that same intelligence background. Yeah. And so, yeah, so, you know, especially you got to ask the question, were those just the only people that had the talent to make it, you know, at that time? Or was there another reason that they were sort of groomed for those positions, you know, which in my opinion is it's the latter, that they were definitely groomed to basically fill those positions and, you know, and lead the 60s youth movement in ways that the powers that be wanted it moved.
Wow. Why don't you tell the audience where Laurel Canyon is, just in case somebody isn't aware of where it is. And and you also mentioned the Hollywood, the movie stars that live there, and you talk about the deaths. Now, you can read the what Dave has talked about at his website. He's got, what is it, like 15 or 16 parts?
I think it's actually 18 parts now. It's like nearly book length. It's, yeah, and amply illustrated with lots of photos, and that'll kind of, you know, give you a feel for this area. Yeah, Laurel Canyon, basically, it's not actually, it's a part of Los Angeles. It's not actually a separate city, but it's a separate community, so to speak, in that it's very isolated and remote. It's up in the Hollywood Hills, you know, in this very remote, very woodsy, very rustic setting that has really a totally different feel from the rest of L.A., which is, you know, just sort of a big industrial wasteland, you know. But Laurel Canyon, it's very remote, it's very private, you know, there's basically one way in and one way out, you know, on Laurel Canyon Boulevard. So it's very private, very remote, and very close-knit, and, you know, they have their own school and their own little grocery store. And so it's really sort of a separate and unique community. And in the 60s, it was overrun with all of the pop stars, the rock stars, the early hippies. You know, basically it was the beginning of the hippie movement, which is one thing that a lot of people, or most people, associate that much more so with San Francisco and the Haight-Ashbury. But Laurel Canyon was really L.A.'s version of Haight-Ashbury, and it actually preceded. It came along before, so the movement actually started in Laurel Canyon, and you know, then moved out elsewhere. And so that's basically the background of this story is how all of these people came together in this one small isolated location and created really this sort of youth revolution that you know, as far as the music and the hairstyles and the fashions and the, you know, the whole mythos of the 1960s hippie movement really started there in this little community. So that's kind of the background basically of Laurel Canyon.
Sure. And you're suggesting that it was not spontaneous but was rather orchestrated and planned, and that people were actually groomed to participate in this music scene.
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, it just it was very odd because L.A. was not at the time really known as a mecca of music. It wasn't really a hub of the music industry. New York and Nashville and Detroit, yeah, the really, yeah, you know, pop music was kind of centered in New York. You know, you had rhythm and blues in Detroit, and you know, country in Nashville, and L.A. was a very insignificant player, and yet it just literally, like almost overnight, became the capital of the music industry as all of these people just came flooding in. And, you know, took root in Laurel Canyon and all began playing the same kind of music, which was folk rock, which was really kind of born there. And it just, you know, and you read the sort of mainstream conventional histories and they would have you believe that it was just sort of this spontaneous, organic, you know, grassroots kind of thing that just came together. But, if you really look at it, it doesn't really add up that way. Number one, you know, is the background, and also a lot of these people actually knew each other beforehand. I discovered, like, you know, Frank Zappa's wife, for example, had gone to kindergarten, naval kindergarten, with Jim Morrison. You know, way back when they were like 5 years old. You know, and And Warren Beatty, who was another of the Young Turks, you know, he was a high school rival of a basketball rival of John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas, you know, and they both years later ended up in Laurel Canyon. Cass Elliott came from the same high school, you know, so you have all of these prior connections between these people that kind of refute the notion that it was just sort of a other, you know, and in addition, all of their intelligence background and the fact that a very high percent of them came directly from the Washington, D.C. area.
Right. Could you hold that thought, Dave? We do have to take another 3-minute break, and we will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back, friends. My guest today is Dave McGowan, and his website is davesweb.cnchost.com. It's also linked on the radio schedule page. Now, just before the break, you were talking about so many of these people also came from the Washington, D.C. area.
A very high percentage of them. You know, one of the monkeys, Peter Tork, I believe, was from there. As I already mentioned, you know, John Phillips and Cass Elliott, Warren Beatty, just a whole bunch of them. I'm drawing a blank right now, unfortunately.
You said Jim Morrison's father was kind of complicit in the Bay of Tonkin incident. And so kind of explain what was going on at the time. We were going into the Vietnam War, lots and lots of things going on at the time.
Yeah, there was a lot going on. There was quite a bit of turmoil. The Vietnam War was definitely heating up. You know, we were already in there, but you know, more or less covertly, we did not have troops, boots on the ground, as they say these days. And the Gulf of the Tonkin incident, which is when, you know, a couple of U.S. destroyers were allegedly attacked in the Gulf by Vietnamese forces, which was later, you know, hotly disputed whether it even happened. But that is the incident that really turned it around and turned it into a full-scale ground war that eventually cost, what, like 58,000 Americans their lives and God knows how many Vietnamese and Cambodians.
3 million.
Laotians, just literally millions.
Right.
And, you know, that was just heating up. There was already opposition to it. There was a budding anti-war movement, which was primarily centered on college campuses and led by, you know, respectable college professors and their students. And there were various other movements, civil rights movements, women's rights. It was just a time when there was a lot of groups that were sort of, you know, struggling to assert that, you know, their rights. And, you know, the government, you know, knew that this was going to heat up. And so I believe that basically the hippie movement, which became, and in many people's mind is now the face of the 60s anti-war movement, I believe that was very deliberate, and that they did not want to see the anti-war movement continue to grow as a more mainstream sort of movement, and they wanted to marginalize it as much as possible, and so they really just basically created the whole hippie movement and, you know, flower child movement and the, you know, the music that went along with it, and put a face on the anti-war movement that frankly was, you know, offensive to much of mainstream America. You know, I mean, everything about it, from the music to the open drug usage to the hairstyles to the clothing to, you know, everything about it was just you know, offensive to a lot of people. And I believe that was a very deliberate effort, and that, you know, the hippies weren't the original anti-war movement, and were not intended to advance that movement, but rather were intended to marginalize it and put an offensive face on it, basically. So that's basically the way I see it, you know, based on all of the research that I've done at this point.
Sure. Really, so it was a psychological intelligence operation, basically.
Yeah, basically it was. Yeah, very much so. And I think it's very misunderstood by most people in romance, and by me, you know, as one of them. You know, I mean, I was actually born in '60, so I sort of came of age in the '70s, but I always considered myself sort of a hippie that just, you know, had the misfortune of being born 10 years too late. And I always, you know, embraced that music and the whole, you know, the whole countercultural scene. And you know, I believed it was organic. But I can't really believe that anymore, you know, based on. And so this was really kind of a difficult journey for me, because I, you know, I've watched a lot of my former idols kind of fall by the wayside as I realized that, you know, they weren't necessarily what I thought they were.
Sure. Sure. Now, you talk about all the murders in Laurel Canyon, which is amazing. Now, does your book, Program to Kill, The Politics of Serial Murder, does that cover Laurel Canyon, or is that about military?
No, that came out several years before Laurel Canyon. It's more or less about serial killers. It's also about the beginning. Actually, the first section of it is about like organized pedophilia rings, elite, you know, involving top levels of the military and the government and the media and whatnot, and sort of looked into these various cases. I don't know if you cover that sort of thing on your show, but
we cover, you know, a lot of very controversial things. Yes,
like, you know, the it covers a lot of cases, documents a lot of cases that have occurred overseas.
Okay. Dave, we do have to take another 3-minute break. We will be right back. Welcome back, friends. My guest today is Dave McGowan. That's M-C, capital G-O-W-A-N. And he was telling us about his book, Programmed to Kill. It was written in 2004. It is available on Amazon. And so tell us a little bit about that. You were in the middle of telling us about it.
Hard to summarize. It basically covers a lot of high-profile serial killer cases and sort of traces a lot of the hidden threads, a lot of the aspects of these crimes that do not receive a lot of publicity, like indications of mind control, a lot of occult symbolism and overtones, organized pedophilia, like child prostitution, child pornography, hidden intelligence connections, you know, and against this backdrop of extreme violence, obviously. And I reference it quite a bit throughout the Laurel Canyon series. The reason being is that those very same threads run through that story. You find these very... those very same themes, you know, these very, very dark undertones to the Laurel Canyon scene, including the just extreme levels of violence, which you mentioned, I think, in the last segment, that there was just this was supposedly this sort of peace and love and brotherhood scene, but there was just this extreme levels of violence in lurking just below the surface, during that scene. And so I draw a lot of parallels between that, the book, and all of the stuff that I've been researching and writing about concerning Laurel Canyon.
Right, and so many of those musicians and singers died very young, and it seemed like they all died from heroin overdose or an accident or something. But in fact, you say, and this started early, like in the 1920s. And you said, and I quote, Statistically speaking, if you were a famous actor in the 1920s, you would have been better off playing a round of Russian roulette than living in Laurel Canyon, unquote.
Yeah.
And it started there in the 1920s and just moved forward.
Yeah, it's rather uncanny how many deaths, how many curious deaths surrounded that whole scene from the very early years, as you mentioned, and really accelerated during the mid to late 60s and early 70s, and throughout the 70s actually, and it was just unfathomable levels of violence. Like the two most notorious mass murder cases in Los Angeles' history, and Los Angeles has a pretty violent history. So, but according to the grizzled detectives of the LAPD, the two most bloody, brutal mass murders ever committed in the city were the Manson murders on Cielo Drive in Benedict Canyon and the what were known as the Four on the Floor or the Wonderland murders, which actually occurred in Laurel Canyon on Wonderland Boulevard, involved the bludgeoning deaths of four reputed Laurel Canyon drug dealers. And both of those mass murders were directly related to the Laurel Canyon scene. Like I say, the one actually occurred right there in the heart of Laurel Canyon, and the other was a few canyons over, but virtually all of the people involved in it, both victims and perpetrators, were Laurel Canyon regulars. Folger and Frykowski actually lived in a house on, I think it was Woodrow Wilson Drive, directly across the street from the home of Mama Cass, where Charles Manson and some of his followers were reputed to have hung out. Charles Manson was considered by many in the Laurel Canyon crowd to be kind of a peer. He considered himself to be a musician and songwriter and whatnot, and he had a lot of connections to a lot of these people that have been, kept buried for all these years. Some of them are known. He actually lived in Dennis Wilson's home for an entire summer, and Wilson recorded his songs, and the Beach Boys even recorded their own version of one of his songs. But, both of these very high-profile, very violent, very bloody mass murders were directly tied to this peace and love scene. And those were just the two most, most high-profile. There were numerous other murders. Bodies turn up dead in Laurel Canyon, on a regular basis, pretty much. Some well-known, like Ramon Navarro, a former, silent film star that was murdered in his home in the 60s in Laurel Canyon, and an actress whose name escapes me, Ingrid Stevens, I think it was. An uncanny number of people, or people connected to people, several of the wives and girlfriends turned up dead. I think Jackson Brown's wife and Graham Nash's girlfriend and various others. Just a long laundry list of violent murders that were directly connected to this scene.
Right. Now, you also tell about the relationships. For instance, Harlow, Gene Harlow, had three marriages and was the godmother to Bugsy Siegel's daughter, Millicent. And, I mean, you weave all of these relationships together and you think, my goodness, I mean, by the time you get to part four or five, it's just overwhelming. The things that have weaved into your story, the facts, and the network. And you think, well, how did this, not just the musician, the musical scene, but how did Hollywood in general affect our society with the violence?
That's a good question. The thing with this story is, it's, it's kind of a difficult story to tell because it's not like a real linear sort of story. As you mentioned, everything just sort of loops around and is interconnected, and after a while it just seems like everything and everyone is connected to everything, you know? So it's kind of it's a difficult story to tell. But as far as Hollywood is from its very beginnings, from its earliest days, has just been just a very, very violent place. There's always been a backdrop of violence going all the way back to the earliest days, and cases like director Desmond Taylor, I believe his name was, who was murdered in his home way back in, like, I don't know, 1920 something, and various others. Just from the very, very earliest days, Hollywood seem to be infested with these very curious deaths. You know, I mean, if you look back over the years, all the way back, as you say, you know, there's just case after case after case of unsolved murders, they're not always listed as murders, but you know, if you really look at the details, they clearly are, and. Yeah. Hollywood to me is really just has always been sort of a branch of the CIA, sort of the entertainment branch of the CIA. I think it's just been filled with laced with intelligence operations from day one, and that mind control really kind of runs rampant in Hollywood among the, you know, musicians and the acting community. I think it's just everywhere, you know, it seems to be anyway. And I think it's a very, very controlled, community, and, you know, it really couldn't be any other way when you think about it. The reach that Hollywood has, to influence public opinion, not just here, but pretty much around the world. It's always just been this hugely influential force, and, you know, to think that it would be allowed to run independently of the intelligence community is really, to me, seems to be kind of naive, you know?
Certainly, certainly. You mention in your book, you should write a book. You should put this all in a book. This is such fabulous writing, and it's just wonderful. You ought to put it in the book. But you do mention let me find my notes here, about the Lookout Mountain Laboratory, which with such Hollywood luminaries like John Ford, Jimmy Stewart, Howard Hawks, Ronald Reagan, Bing Crosby, Walt Disney, Marilyn Monroe, had some sort of special clearance to work at this facility on undisclosed projects.
Yeah, that's another very curious fact about the whole Laurel Canyon scene, is that right literally smack dab in the middle of this remote canyon, you know, at the time populated primarily with you know, bohemian beatnik musicians and whatnot, there was a covert intelligence facility which was primarily served as a covert film studio. It was actually considered to be the only self-contained film studio in existence. I mean, it was more advanced than anything that Hollywood, just right down the hill, had. And it's where they processed all of the nuclear test film footage and who knows what else they did there, put together propaganda films and whatnot. And it was operating right there, you know. Here you have this secret intelligence facility operating right there in the center of the canyon with all of these sons and daughters of the intelligence community swirling around it, you know, and we're supposed to believe that that's all just, you know, coincidental. But, you know, that's kind of hard to believe. And, yeah, and there were various Hollywood luminaries who had special clearance to actually work at this facility, and to this day, it's not known what exactly they did. But they occasionally reported for duty to this covert film studio and did whatever it is that they did, you know, in conjunction with the, you know, the people running the place. You know, so that's a little odd that would be situated right there. And there was also a high-level male prostitution ring that was being run in Laurel Canyon at that very same time. And when that got raided and shut down, some of the quote unquote workers there claim that their clientele included people as high up as like J. Edgar Hoover, you know. So here you have J. Edgar Hoover, you know, cruising into the Laurel Canyon, you know, to do whatever he's doing, you know. And so there was this, and you know, if your readers are familiar with like the Craig Spence, you know, cowboy case in Washington, D.C., or like the Larry King case in Nebraska, you know, it was basically one of those types of operations that was going on that was serving, you know, very high level clientele. And that was also going on, you know, right there, right there in Laurel Canyon. So there was just so much intelligence activity swirling around what was supposed to be, you know, this organic, you know, bohemian scene that, you know, as I said before, the notion that it was all coincidental went out the window a long, long time ago for me, because there's just way too many things going on there that shouldn't have been going on if this was the scene that we were supposed to believe that it was.
Sure. Now, you talked about James Dean and Nick Adams, and you mentioned that they were both working, and I quote, were working the mean streets of Hollywood as young male prostitutes before their discovery.
That's according to Nick Adams. Some people have disputed that, but that's what Adams claimed, I believe, after Dean had been killed in the curious accident that he was in. And then, of course, Nick Adams himself turned up dead not too long afterwards in his home in, I believe, Coldwater Canyon, which is just one canyon over from Laurel. And, you know, his death was under very, very mysterious circumstances, as were a couple others from you know, co-starred with James Dean. Natalie Wood, of course, her very curious drowning off Catalina Island while in the company of Robert Wagner and Christopher Walken. You know, there's still numerous open questions about that one. And yeah, it's just endless. You know, if you go to the website and read through the series, it's just an unfathomable number of names that of curious deaths that were attached to this whole scene.
Right. And they were young. These people were so young.
Yeah, a lot of them were just really, really young, in their 20s. And, some that were considered really very, very talented and, you know, sort of on the forefront of the scene at the time, that are now like just completely forgotten, even that they burned out so young. I think Judy Still, I think, is the one name of it that I seem to. I can't even remember my own series, but yeah, a lot of them just burned out very, very young. Graham Parsons was one, and just a whole bunch of them, just right down the line.
Right.
And, yeah.
You mentioned that a lot of these musicians weren't really that talented, that it was sort of a facade that was built up, and that on the vinyl, on the record, they sounded great, but in person, it wasn't so great.
That's very true. You know, the Monkees have gotten, and the Monkees were another Laurel Canyon band, by the way, and, you know, very much a part of that scene, and were accepted as by the other, you know, more, credible, so to speak, bands, as peers. You know, they all hung out and jammed together and partied together and whatnot. And which seems odd to people, you know, because the perception that most people have is that the Monkees were not a real band. They were just sort of this media creation, and they didn't write their own music, they didn't play their own music, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is that was not unique at all. A lot of these bands, most of them, in fact, did not play on their own album.
Could you hold that thought, Dave? We do have to take a 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back, friends. My guest today is Dave McGowan. He has written this fabulous, fabulous multi-piece article. It is at davesweb.cnchost.com. And, you know, it's very interesting. Another guest this week, Dr. Michael Jones, said that nudity was actually introduced for the first time in 1965 in The Pawnbroker. And I think that if you kind of piece all these pieces together like as a puzzle, you think, wow, some really bad things were happening in the 60s. That totally altered the youth of this country, that totally altered our culture, and made it more acceptable to it made us accept violence and nudity and all the things that are really pretty bad for our culture. Dave?
Oh, yeah, hi. I wasn't sure if you were done yet. I wasn't aware of the nudity thing in the 60s, starting in the 60s as possible.
Yeah, you were a kid. You were 5.
Yeah, I was only 5 years old, so I wouldn't have seen it even.
You probably didn't see that movie.
But anyway, just before the break, you were talking about how these people didn't really play on their records, and that's one thing that I've gotten a lot of criticism about by email from people who are just outraged that I've suggested that their heroes weren't the musicians that they think they were. And I actually have an article here that just appeared a few months ago in the Wall Street Journal, written by Mark Myers, who talked to Hal Blaine. And Hal Blaine was the drummer for what was known as the Wrecking Crew. The Wrecking Crew was a team of crack studio musicians that included people like Leon Russell before he became famous on keyboards, and Hal Blaine was the drummer. Glenn Campbell, believe it or not, was actually one of the guitarists. And but anyway, these were a very, very much in-demand group of studio musicians, and they were the ones who really made almost all of the of the records that came out of L.A. in the 60s and 70s. It's astonishing, really. And I just wanted to read a few excerpts from here so that people will stop accusing me of, like, making this stuff up.
Sure.
And the article says, outraged that the Monkees didn't play on all of their recordings. Well, it turns out that neither did the Beach Boys, the Mamas and the Papas, the Byrds, the Association, Jan and Dean, and dozens of others. And then this is a quote from Hal Blaine himself. He says, "This is going to break your heart, but much of the music you heard in the 60s and early 70s wasn't recorded by the people you saw on the album covers. It was done by me and the musicians you see on these walls. Many of these kids didn't have the chops and were little more than garage bands," said Blaine. Then the reporter asked, "Is this why so many groups back then didn't sound as good in concert as they did on their records?" And he says, "You tell me," Mr. Blaine said, laughing. "At concerts, people hear with their eyes. Teens cut groups slack in concert, but not when they bought their records." So this is coming directly from the guy who actually did play on those records, that these people were not, in fact, professional quality musicians, and they could not really perform their songs, you know, in a lot of cases. And so all of those studio tracks were not recorded by the people that, as he said, by the people whose pictures were on the album covers.
Interesting. We do have to take a 1-minute top of the hour break, and then we will be right back with our guest today, Dave McGowan. Stay tuned. Welcome back, friends. This is the second hour of Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. My guest today is Dave McGowan, the author of Derailing Democracy, The America the Media Don't Want You to See, Understanding the F Word, and Programmed to Kill, The Politics of Serial Murder, three books. Plus, he has also written this multi-part, it's called Inside the LC, The Strange but Mostly True Story of Laurel Canyon and the Birth of the Hippie Generation. Now, that's just one thing that's very interesting on his website. He's also written about the moon landing, which I hope he will come back at some other day and talk about that. His website is davesweb.cnchost.com. I did have an email over the break. Tom asked Dave to get into David Crosby and Stephen Stills. He says that he was at a CSNY concert in Tampa, Florida in 1974, and between songs, Stephen Stills blurted out that he spent a lot of time when he was young during the summer hanging out with his gung-ho military uncles in their compound near Bartow, Florida. And he said that he remembered thinking at the time that that was a kind of a strange statement.
Yeah, Stephen Stills' dad apparently was some kind of shadowy intel operative. It's generally difficult to discern that from the mainstream biographies, but little bits and pieces I picked up would seem to indicate that. And he seemed to be particularly active in, Central American affairs, and Stills actually lived part of his childhood down there in various places in and around military bases, I believe, covert operations type bases and stuff. And he actually was known to tell people that he had covertly served over in Vietnam in the very early years of Vietnam before we had had ground troops there. And that's been almost universally dismissed by his various biographers and whatnot as being an impossibility because, he was on the music scene by the time we had troops on the ground in Vietnam, so it's been regarded as not being possible. But it is, in fact, quite possible that he could have been because, if he had been there, it would have been in a covert capacity, and we certainly did have, quote-unquote, advisors all over the country before we, officially had troops on the ground. So it remains kind of an open question. Was he a covert operative over there before, just a year or two before he emerged as, as one of the Laurel Canyon musicians? It's quite possible given his family background. David Crosby's father, Floyd Delafield Crosby, also did some intelligence work, and Crosby actually comes from one of the elite bloodline, American bloodlines. His full name is David Van Cortlandt Crosby, and he is a direct descendant of these three sort of interlinked families, the Van Rensselaer, Van Cortlandt, and Van Schuyler, not sure how it's pronounced, families that were all sort of intermarried and go back like to the founding of the country. And if you go on like Wikipedia and hit up those names, Van Cortlandt, Van Rensselaer, or Van Schuyler, you'll see that he comes from a long and very prestigious line of, senators, congressmen, Civil War and Revolutionary War generals, signers of the Declaration of Independence, and just, all of these, his family has been, sort of at the top of the food chain for a couple
long
hundred
time.
Years.
Yeah. We do have to take a 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. My guest today is Dave McGowan. His website is davesweb.cnchost.com. And just scroll down and you will see his article, Inside the LC, The Strange but Mostly True Story of Laurel Canyon and the Birth of the Hippie Generation. Also, we have about 15 minutes until the pledge drive ends, so if you have not donated, you still have time. Tell us about Sal Mineo. You were talking about the Crosby family. First, let's get back to the Crosby family. You were talking about the roots all the way back to the founders. And I think that is so interesting because if you look at some of the people and some of their family connections, you think, my gosh, it would appear that the same elite group of people have been controlling things for generations and generations, and now they're just controlling it, controlling the culture in a totally different way through, counterculture with the music in the 60s and the films and basically television itself is really a vehicle for mind control, because they are presenting what they would have us believe is culture, when in fact the stuff that people see on TV may not have any connection or relationship at all to their own family or their own life.
Yeah, it's absolutely, TV really is a very insidious invention. It was really the sort of the beginning of sort of isolating us, in this country. Before that, entertainment was a much more of a sort of a public thing. You'd gather in the public square or, whatever it was. TV, when TV was introduced, that's when, it really began to break the social bonds and the community ties, and people began, just huddling in their own homes with their families, watching, Ed Sullivan or whatever it was back then. And, it really began to sort of isolate us into smaller and smaller units, so to speak, and computers and the internet has really even accelerated that. So we're really being sort of isolated into islands of one.
And that's
not accidental. That's very deliberate. As time goes on and technology proliferates, it gets harder and harder for people to organize. To seek some real significant change in this country, and it's going to get harder and harder as we become more and more socially isolated. It's very ironic that we're supposed to be even more and more connected than ever now through social networking and Twitter and Facebook and all that, but it really serves to isolate us, and I see it in my kids, and it really bothers me, when I was a kid, when school was out, all the kids were running amok, and if you went out, like, after school, drove by a school, you'd see kids out playing in the playground and doing their thing and out in the streets playing, and my kids, My kids come home from school, they go straight to their room and log on to their computer, and pick up their cell phone, and they got, one conversation going on the computer and another one going by text message, on their phone or their iPods or whatever, and, I just put all that stuff down and go outside and actually interact face to face with your friends, So yeah, it's really been a very insidious process of sort of isolating us more and more socially and making us more and more powerless,
Right. And you really have to understand that beginning in the late 1920s, in 1927 when they had the Radio Act, that our media is controlled by the government.
Oh, very much. It's totally controlled. And it may appear that there's like to some people that there's like a huge difference between like Fox News and MSNBC or whatever. But they're using slightly different just sort of slightly different techniques, but they're all basically pushing the country in the direction that, you know, those at the top of the food chain want it to go. And it's been like that for a very long time.
Certainly. You talked in your article, we'll get back to Salminio, but as long as we're talking about Fox News, you talked in your article, I don't remember which part it was, but about Joe Pyne and how he kind of paved the way for the likes of Bill O'Reilly, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Michael Savage, Don Imus, Morton Downey, Jerry Springer, all those people. I don't know who Joe Pyne is, but other than
I didn't article. Either. I only know about him through what I've read. But, yeah, apparently he was a very early sort of muckraker that would have very controversial guests on and get in shouting matches with them and which is, you know, very controversial for the time. And, yeah, he kind of set the stage for this whole sort of very confrontational, very bombastic style that we see, like, everywhere nowadays. He was kind of the guy that pioneered that, first on the radio and on the TV and then on the TV show. And I think it was more of a local phenomenon than a nationwide one. And, you know, I don't remember the guy at all, just from what I've read. But yeah, apparently he was kind of a trendsetter. He was like he was a Marine veteran and very rough and tumble kind of guy that would just, you know, just basically just tell his guests exactly what he thought of them. And he ended up dying very young, too, I believe, didn't he?
He died at the age of 45, March 23rd, 1970, according to your article.
Yeah, well, it was fairly young. And to me, it's young. It's
right.
Younger than I am now. So it didn't seem young once upon a time, but it seems young now.
Right. Okay, let's talk about Salminio. He was a singer?
He was an actor. He was another contemporary of James Dean, actually. He was part of that, you know, James Dean, Dennis Hopper, Nick Adams clique. They all appeared together in one of those big name. What was it? James Dean only did like two or three films, you know, that established this long-lasting legacy. And
right,
one
like
of them,
Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah, Rebel Without, was that the one? It was either Rebel Without a Cause or Giant, East of Eden.
East of Eden. I know that I've seen them. Just the things that they played in kind of promoted that same kind of mentality.
Yeah, and then Salminio was another member of that group and another one that died very, very young and who died right at the mouth of Laurel Canyon, who was murdered in the driveway parking structure of his apartment building right at the mouth of Laurel Canyon. Along with all the other trail of bodies. Yeah, he was yet another young Hollywood personality who met a very tragic and violent end right in the midst of this whole scene that was going on at the time.
I find that. That's kind of fascinating that all these people died so young. I mean, if they were serving an intelligence operation purpose, were they murdered? Who would have murdered them? I mean, what would be behind something like that?
That's a question I get a lot, you know, is people are like, well, does that mean that they were like the good guys, you know, and that they had to be silenced, they had to get gotten rid of, and I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I think they're all sort of considered expendable for a cause, you know, And I just believe that at some point some of them, you know, had outlived their usefulness. They were maybe considered of more value dead than alive, or you know, perhaps they had become a problem. Maybe their programming was breaking down or something. I don't know. And you know, that it had been determined that they had become more of a liability than an asset. I can't really answer that question definitively. You know, there's probably different reasons for different people, but, you know, I mean, a lot of them a lot of them died very young, you know, or maybe didn't, you know. Then there's some of them, you know, like Jim Morrison, that still to this day people question whether he really did die at 27. You know, he was, as we already noted, another key member of the Laurel Canyon scene and one who died young, but about whom there's still questions to this day whether he really did die or just sort of faked it. And you know, having served his purpose in that milieu, had you know, faked his death and reemerged as someone else, because he was quite a chameleon. He definitely had the ability to you know, take on various personas, and it's quite possible in my mind that he did in fact fake his death. I don't know, what have you read much about that, or?
No, I haven't, but I was thinking of other people who might have faked their deaths, and I'm trying to think of the so-called conservative reporter that was married to, I can't think. She was on one of the planes, and she supposedly called her husband, who was the attorney general.
Olson,
yes. I was thinking, like, gosh, I wonder if she did. That's what I was kind of thinking when you were saying that.
Yeah,
we do have to take a 3-minute break, but think about that, and we'll be back in 3 minutes. All righty, we are back, and my guest today is Dave McGowan, and we were talking about the Olson woman, and I mean, I think it's just very interesting that her husband is married to someone that kind of looks almost like his former wife.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, you dropped out for a minute there. I didn't catch.
Okay, yeah. His current wife looks very similar to what Olson looked like.
Does she? I was not aware. I didn't even know that he'd been remarried.
Yeah.
I was not aware of that. But, yeah, that was a rather curious incident, yeah, that she just happened to be supposedly on one of those planes and happened to be the one that made a couple of cell phone calls.
Said she did. I mean, it's not even possible above 5,000 feet. I mean, I don't know. I got an email during the break, and it said, Laurel Canyon series, what a fantastic read. I turned 13, and this is from Stephen. I turned 13 on the day the Beatles appeared on The Sullivan Show for the first time. Within a year, I was growing my hair long and singing in a band in junior high, The British Invasion. It was very effective. What an intriguing read. Thanks, Dave. You referenced Lori Jacobson in your work. I grew up with her. She was one of my fans. Do you know her personally? And this is from Steve.
No, I don't know any of these people personally, no. And they probably have, if they are familiar with my series, they probably wouldn't want to be associated with me personally. But I don't know any of these people. I've never spoken to any of them.
You know, it's interesting that Steve grew his hair long and started playing in a band, and now we have such characters like Lady Gaga and Britney Spears. And young women are emulating them, which I think is just horribly disgusting. We do have some callers on the line. Let's take a couple of calls. Let's take Larry from Louisiana. Larry, welcome to the program.
Hi. What did you have got on Robert Zimmerman as far as his ties to the CIA or his family or the military-industrial complex or Skull and Bones or like that?
Dylan?
Yeah.
I have not actually looked into him. He was not part of the Laurel Canyon scene. He was actually the head of the Greenwich Village scene, which I have thought about possibly looking into in the future, but as of now I have not looked into either that or the backgrounds of the various San Francisco bands. I've also considered, you know, branching out into that, but have not gotten into that at this point. So I couldn't really, I know very little about him at this point.
Okay, well, listen to Desolation Row and then look at the Jonestown incident, and you'll see it way ahead of time. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Larry. Okay, let's take Steve in Arizona. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is an interesting subject, and I hope you guys do more future shows like more like this, like culture and music, because I'm tired about hearing about the Fed all the time. But at any rate, I wanted to ask the guest what his connection. Are you connected to Laurel Canyon anyway? Did you grow up in that area, and were you connected to the music industry?
No, I was not connected to the music industry. I did grow up in the area. I was born and raised. I was actually born and raised in Torrance, suburb of L.A., and I've lived my entire life, 51 years now, in various parts of the L.A. area. And I used to drive actually through Laurel Canyon daily because it's the most convenient way to get from the part of the valley I was living at to the west side. So I actually years and years before I ever started this series, I regularly traveled through Laurel Canyon, but never gave it any thought. It was just a way to get across town, basically, no different than any other route. And it was only when I started doing all this research just a few years ago that it sort of took on a whole new significance for me. And and I began hanging out there quite a bit, just wandering around, taking pictures, just getting a feel for the place. So I that's my only real connection to it, is that I grew up around it and for a while, hung out there for a bit just to get a feel for the place.
Okay, because I want to go back there, back to Laurel Canyon one day, and I was wondering if you could tell me if there's any special spots that I could check out on Laurel Canyon.
Well, probably the most well known spots are the corner where the alleged Houdini mansion sits, which is now in ruins, and right across the street from that, which is where the former log cabin sat, which was a very well-known gathering spot during this. It was run for a while by Frank Zappa. He lived there and basically ran it as sort of an open house for the Laurel Canyon musicians. But unfortunately, that is now gone and fenced in, and the Houdini Mansion burned down, way back in like 59 or something like that. But you can still see sort of the ruins of those two places right on the corner of Laurel Canyon Boulevard and Lookout Mountain Road, I think. And then farther down is the Laurel Canyon Country Store, which is sort of a landmark. It was a very, very popular hangout time for the various musicians. There are various other places that are very interesting, like the Wonderland Murder House, which is still there, still standing, hasn't changed a bit. It looks exactly like it did at the time. But those are harder to find if you don't know your way around.
Okay, we do have to take a break. We will be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back, friends. My guest today is Dave McGowan, and his website, davesweb.cnchost.com. And you were talking with Steve from Arizona. Steve, did you have another question? Or
yeah, I'm interested in three people in particular. I'm interested in Frank Zappa, Neil Young, and Jackson Browne. If you could just kind of briefly go into those three guys. What was Frank Zappa all about? Was he like the head of the Laurel Canyon scene, or what was his deal?
He was one of the main figures there. He basically, as I said, he ran this log cabin which had originally been owned by Tom Mix. It was this big, huge, rambling structure that he and his wife and kids lived in, and they basically ran it as sort of an open house that all of the other Laurel Canyon musicians would regularly stop by and just have jam sessions and party and whatnot. And it was just sort of a continuous flow of people. There were several houses like that in Laurel Canyon. John Phillips' house was another one. Cass Elliott's was another one, that were just regular gathering spots. So they were some of the key figures definitely, in the canyon. Zappa, he had a very interesting history. You know, his dad, as I said, was a was a, I believe it was a chemical warfare engineer at the Edgewood Arsenal, and actually lived in the facility. Frank Zappa actually spent the first several years of his childhood actually living at, on the grounds of the Edgewood Arsenal, you know, of all places. So, yeah, he had a very, very unusual upbringing. Jackson Brown, I'm drawing a blank on Jackson Brown, actually. I know I covered him in there, but I...
Yeah, it's in the first two or second or third part. But, yeah, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
We do have some other callers.
Okay.
So thanks very much, Steve, for calling in. Barry, let's take Barry in California.
How you guys doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. You mentioned about mind control. It's been mentioned that Britney Spears and Christine Aguilera, which they were musketeers in the Musketeer Club.
Oh yeah.
That Freeman, he covers a lot of the symbolism of the New World Order. Him and Tex Mars have partnered up together, and he mentions them, that they're part of the Ultra mind control.
Mm-hmm. MK Ultra. Mm-hmm.
Does your, and then I have another question, but who is actually controlling this whole thing from the 60s on? Is it part of the Zionists or, you know, because they do control Hollywood?
Dave, what do you think?
As far as like the Britney, I would tend to agree that definitely Britney, people like Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera are most likely or almost certainly mind control victims. But I think that's really just the tip of the iceberg. I think it runs rampant in Hollywood. I think a very large proportion of Hollywood is controlled, you know, and it's long been said that, Hollywood is controlled by the agents, you know, meaning the talent agents. And I think that statement is true on a number of levels. I would tend to agree with that. As far as who's been running the show for all these years, that's a good question. Virtually every conceivable quote unquote secret society and every big name that's ever come up in the conspiracy literature has surfaced in my research in connection with one or more of these people. Whether it's the Masons or the Rothschilds or Skull and Bones or the OTO or any of these other names or organizations or figures that regularly come out in the conspiracy literature can be found woven through this story. Who ultimately pulls the strings? I couldn't really answer that. I don't know. I wish I did know. My view of how the world works is still a sort of evolving, 10 years ago I thought that I understood how the world works, and I was actually very naive at the time, and I ventured down a lot of very dark rabbit holes since then and realized that things are actually much worse than even I had thought, and it's a learning process for me as well, and I hope to one day have all the answers, but I, as of now, I couldn't really tell you.
And just one more quick question. Lady Gaga, I just got an email that in her shows, she brings in a lot of the New World Order, and then on her makeup, she has the eye of Cyrus.
Her videos are just filled with occult and New World Order type symbolism, and she's an interesting one. I mean, the stars of today, I mentioned earlier that talent wasn't necessarily the main reason that these 60s idols you know, became the big stars that they are. And I think that's generally true in Hollywood. And more we seem to see these just really manufactured, prepackaged entertainers just sort of arise out of nowhere. I mean, how old is this lady? She's like 24 years old or something. I don't know. And I mean, a few years ago, she was like virtually unknown, and now she's like the biggest thing in the world, you know. And to me, that's not really based on talent from what I've seen and heard. You know, these people just seem to emerge as these fully formed, you know, prepackaged media sensations. And, you know, and it's all laced with symbolism, and you know, there's a lot of overtones of mind control, and I believe it's all aimed at sort of keeping the, herding the people onto the path that they want us to take, you know?
Yeah, I believe that we have to be careful what our kids are listening to and watching, because it does go into the subliminal mind
and
the consciousness.
Yeah, you know, Deanna's mentioned a couple of times about how, you know, television and Hollywood in general has really sort of desensitized us to ever-increasing levels of violence and various other things. And one of the things that I find most disturbing is the sexualization of children that as she mentioned, you know, the people like Lady Gaga are sort of pushed as role models, you know, for preteen girls, and more and more, yeah, it just seems to be there seems to be a major effort in that regard, you know, and that actually, in a way, that ties back to Laurel Canyon, because I don't know if people remember this, but John Phillips, who was definitely one of the key figures in the Laurel Canyon scene, and really was one of the main guys that helped to mainstream that scene by putting together the Monterey Pop Festival and sort of bringing that whole scene to the rest of the country. But anyway, his daughter Bijou, when she was just 14, was in an ad campaign put on by Calvin Klein that was just so wildly inappropriate that it was actually investigated by the U.S. Justice Department as being potentially child pornography. You know, so here you have the daughter of one of these key Laurel Canyon figures that was helping to push that agenda along in a big way. So, you know, as I said before, everything just kind of goes in circles and ties back into, you know. So, anyway.
Thank you for your answers. You guys have a nice day.
Thanks, Barry. Okay, we have a couple email questions. Going to Doris Day's association with some of these shady characters.
Doris Day was the mother of Terry Melcher, who actually lived in the Cielo Drive house with his then-girlfriend Candace Bergen, the house where the Manson murders were committed. And Terry Melcher actually had direct connections to Charles Manson, and he was one of the key industry people behind the Laurel Canyon music scene. He was a producer and for various of these bands, and he actually had very, very close association with Manson, and at one point was supposedly going to sign and record him, and, you know, help make him into yet another, you know, but, you know, Charlie Manson's could have had a much different life arc, you know, rather than
right.
being now known as one of America's most notorious killers. He could have been up there with, you know, Neil Young and David Crosby and Jim Morrison is one of the figures of the 60s music scene, you know, strangely enough. So yeah, that was how Terry Melcher was tied into that whole thing, and he being the son of Doris Day.
Wow. Okay, another question. He says, I know this is not about Laurel Canyon, but what about Yoko Ono? And he says, I believe she was some sort of government asset, and John Lennon, at age 40, was taken out for some reason. Their bed in and the rest of their lifestyle was too bizarre. your comments.
I have not written anything about that because it's not really connected to the scene, but I tend to think that that Yoko probably set him up, actually, from what I've read and heard over the years. I believe that she was very likely in on the plot or her behavior at the time, and I think she probably was, very much involved in that. But as the caller indicated, it's not directly related to Laurel Canyon, and I haven't really looked into it that deeply or written about it, but that's just my own personal take on it, is that, she probably was.
Sure. Another question. Could you ask Dave if the Manson gang had X's or swastikas on their heads at the time of the court hearings?
Yeah. Well, it started out as an X. Yeah, he carved an X in his forehead, and then a number of the girls did as well. And then he converted it into a swastika, and they did. Yeah, and there's actually old pictures you can find of the girls, groups of them hanging out in front of these little bands of hippie Manson girls hanging out in front of the courthouse out on the street with their little head carvings. Yeah.
Interesting. But, oh my goodness. What possesses people to engage in such a lifestyle? Is it for fame and fortune, or I just don't understand that kind of mentality. Why people would even want to be a part of that?
As far as his followers, you mean?
As far as all of these people, why would any of these people even want to be a part of that? Is it for fame and fortune? Why would people choose such a lifestyle for all these musicians?
I don't necessarily believe that they chose it. I tend to think that it was most likely chosen for them, and that they were basically, groomed from a very early age to fill these positions. Just like I think a lot of politicians, I think Obama was groomed for his position,
Oh, I agree there,
early,
yes.
I think these people are just, they're part of bloodline families or whatever it is, and they're chosen from a very early age and sort of groomed and programmed to fill a particular role in society. A position that has a large impact on public opinion,
Okay, yeah. I think you said that. It's just so hard to believe. And of course, in as much as that would not be a particularly good lifestyle, it makes sense that they were brainwashed and groomed and programmed to participate in it.
Yeah, well, it doesn't make for a very lengthy life in most cases, or a very healthy life, I mean, a lot of these people were pretty severe drug addicts, to a pretty extreme degree, There was just the massive amount of drugs that were being pumped into the canyon at the time as well. It was decidedly not a healthy lifestyle. And for a lot of them, they didn't make it very far.
Now you mentioned in connection with, the Lookout Mountain Laboratory, you mentioned Ronald Reagan. Do you suppose that he was groomed also to be the president?
Oh, I would imagine so, yeah. I think most of the presidents in my lifetime and probably well beyond that were most likely groomed for the presidency, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about Walt Disney? I've heard some very unsavory things about him.
I've heard a lot of unsavory things. I mean, there's so much, rumors of Nazi affiliations, rumors of pedophilia, just all sorts of unsavory, stories that have circulated about him. How much of it is true? I would tend to think that probably at least a good portion of it probably is, but could I definitively state that at this point? No, not really. It's not not something that I've spent a huge amount of time. You know, I mean, I know that he was intimately involved with some of the Nazi scientists that were brought over in the paperclip project, particularly Wernher von Braun, you know, the one of the key figures in the Apollo project. He definitely, and he's the one that really helped sell von Braun to the American people, you know, despite his rather sordid past. But you know, I couldn't really say, but I would tend to think that probably he wasn't the nice old Uncle Walt or whatever that we're supposed to believe that he was.
Sure.
Would be my gut instinct.
We do have to take our last 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Stay tuned. Welcome back, friends. My guest today has been Dave McGowan. His website is davesweb.cnchost.com. And another listener wants to know if you've ever heard of the book called Thanks for the Memories. Apparently some of the things that you've been telling us about are in that book.
Yeah, I am familiar. It was written by Bryce Taylor, I believe, is the pseudonym she used. I think her real name is like Susan Ford. And it's a self-published book. Came out, I don't know when, but quite a ways back. I read it years and years and years ago, and it's basically her sort of the story of her personal journey through as a lifelong mind control victim of and she names people like, you know, high-level politicians like Henry Kissinger, as well as very high-level Hollywood personalities like Bob Hope, as being her torturers and programmers. And Disneyland, I believe, played a key role in that. I think a lot of the, from what I remember, I think she's indicated that a lot of the programming had been sort of keyed into to Disneyland themes, or it had even occurred at Disneyland, I believe. So I'm familiar with it. I believe that I don't necessarily believe everything that's in there. I think she's very sincere and that she very much believes it, but I think there's some aspects of it that maybe a little off the mark, but the basic concepts that she's talking about are undoubtedly, unfortunately, a reality.
Right. I think there's so many things that we really, when we learn something, we think, oh, gosh, I can't believe that. And after we hear it, a second or a third time, we think, okay, yeah, that's probably true. But this is amazing. Another question. What about Squeaky Frome's attempted assassination of Ford?
Yeah, that was another weird one, wasn't it? Yeah, you got one of the Manson girls, later attempting to become a presidential assassin, and which isn't really all that surprising when you realize that the Manson family was in all likelihood a CIA-run mind control program, so that one of them would later emerge as a potential presidential assassin probably shouldn't really shock us. Squeaky Frome, by the way, went to high school with Phil Hartman. Saturday Night
really?
Live.
Really? Oh.
Yeah. Who was also a key Laurel Canyon figure. Before he became well-known as a comedian, he was actually a graphic artist, and he, like, designed album covers for some of these Laurel Canyon bands and even designed the CSN logo. The logo that the band CSN uses to this day was designed by Phil Hartman. And
wow.
He was yet another victim of violent crime at a very young age, supposedly killed by his wife, I think it was. Story that made no sense whatsoever. So here you have another tie-in to all of it. So, you know, like I said, everything just goes around and around in circles, you know, and you just keep trying to follow it wherever it goes, you know.
Sure. We have run out of time, Dave. Will you come back?
Oh, sure. Love to.
Ah, we'd love to have you back. So thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, listeners. Talk to you tomorrow.